Our guest this week is Sergeant First Class William Tomlin, United States Army and recipient of the Silver Star for heroic actions taken while serving in Operation Enduring Freedom. First off, what inspired you to join the Army, and when did you join?
Well, I first came on active duty in 1998. I had been in college and simultaneously in the National Guard to help pay for college. When I was getting ready to graduate, I didn't really feel like I was ready to join corporate America just yet, so I decided to join the Army and told myself that it would just be for 3 years, just to go and have a little bit of fun and a little bit of adventure. And it turned out that I really liked it, so I decided to stick around for a while.
So you've been in the Army now for 11 years.
Yes, that's correct.
So I'm guessing you've seen quite a bit during your time.
Yes, I've been to three different duty stations. I've been deployed four times, twice to Afghanistan and twice to Iraq.
And when were your deployments? When did they run?
My first Afghanistan deployment was January of 03 to August of 03. And then I did Iraq from January of 04 to April of 04. Then Iraq again from September of 05 to January of 06. And then Afghanistan from January of 07 to April of 08.
So obviously you've had a really good opportunity to watch things as they've come along and progress. I guess with Afghanistan, what were your impressions of Afghanistan, the people, and just serving there?
Afghanistan, to me, I think it's kind of a typical third world country in that they exercise more belief in their local politics versus their national politics. A lot of them don't even understand the concept of a central government. The people there have tribal associations instead of political beliefs. So the interesting thing is, like, you might have two tribes in one village, and the people won't talk to the people in the other tribe.
So I'd imagine that really kind of throws a wrench in the way that you would expect to be interacting with the people and working with them.
Oh, absolutely. Because if I want to talk to a key leader in a village, I might think I'm talking to the right person, and in fact, I'm only talking to somebody who represents half of the population.
Now, April 9th, 2007 was the date that this action took place. How long had you been in Afghanistan to that point?
At that point, we had been there for approximately 4 months.
Okay, so you had been there a little while at that point. Had you been seeing a lot of action during those 4 months?
We hadn't seen much up until around the end of March. Actually, it was really quiet for us for the first couple of months. And then right around the end of March, we changed missions and went to a different area, and that's when things started to pick up for us.
And I understand that even though these actions took place on April 9th, 2007, that you had been engaged in fierce fighting for 2 days prior to that.
That's true. In Sangin, Afghanistan, our battalion did a big mission there, and we had been fighting in there for approximately 3 days.
And what was your mission, and where did this take place?
The action on April 9th actually took place in a small village called Chakak, which is about 25 kilometers north of Sangin. We were tasked with doing a forced reconnaissance up to that village to try and find the key leaders and talk to them and see, you know, gather environmentals and see if it was worth bringing, you know, another element up into that area. And what ended up happening was, as we were setting in our security, we ended up getting ambushed and maneuvered upon by an enemy force about six times greater than ours.
So let's go through the actions of April 9th that day. You and your platoon had about 45 men, and you're attacked by about 300 fighters, correct?
That's correct. Initially, like I said, we set into our security position. We started going around to the houses that were the closest to us, clearing them, and we noticed that there wasn't anybody in any of them, and that's pretty common if you're about to be engaged. That was our first combat indicator. So I took a sniper team and I displaced them to see, you know, so they could start getting eyes on away from the main effort, from the main element. It's pretty much as soon as they got into position, the main element started receiving machine gun and RPG fire. And as the snipers were looking to see exactly where it was coming from so that we could start suppressing accurately, they came in contact themselves to the point where they could no longer observe and we had to get them out of that situation. And as we were focusing on getting them back to the rest of the platoon is when we started getting maneuvered on from the opposite side.
And I, from what I understand, they closed to about 15 meters from your position, correct?
That's correct. From where they were actually able to assemble, there was an alleyway that was about 100 meters long that we couldn't cover with our machine guns, and they were able to move right up that alleyway and get to about 15 meters from a couple of our trucks. And we started, at that point, just throwing grenades back and forth at each other.
And you led a counterattack against them once they closed. And I should point out that this fight started at about 9:30 a.m. It's 120 degrees out almost by that point, and it's going about 6 hours in length, right?
That's correct. Yeah, it started late morning and went into the middle of the afternoon, and it was hot the whole time.
When you led this counterattack, can you tell us a little bit about what exactly you did at this time?
Well, what happened was as they moved up the alleyway and they started shooting from around the corner, I realized exactly how close they were. And at that, you know, at 15 meters, it's anybody's game. We don't have that. We don't have the advantage. We like to have standoff because we can shoot better and we have better weapons than they do. Once I realized how close they were, we knew we had to get them out of that situation. So we were able to push them back down the alley with hand grenades and small arms. And then we kind of chased them down the hill into the village a little bit. The problem was that we couldn't have any more support from our machine guns down inside the village. And the scout platoon doesn't have enough manpower to actually maneuver by itself and effectively fight. So that was one of the things that we struggled with all day long, and that's what led to our calling in for reinforcements.
And so once reinforcements were able to make it into the fight, you were pretty much able to drive these guys back, right?
Well, we had gotten reinforced with one platoon. We put them on a hilltop to our south. And as soon as they got into position, they started receiving accurate and effective fire, too, and they were getting maneuvered on as well. So what ended up happening was we ended up getting two more platoons and put them on hilltops up to the north, and what that gave us was enough land that we owned where they couldn't maneuver around us anymore, and then they had to engage us only from the front. And it was at that point that we could actually really start pushing them back, since they couldn't get around us, they couldn't flank us. But unfortunately, once we started to be able to start moving forward down into the poppy fields and everything, that's when we started running low on ammunition. And we also started receiving a lot of indirect fire. So at that point, we had to break contact to the east, back out into the desert.
During this fight, you would think that at such close combat that you would really receive a number of casualties. But from what I understand, you didn't receive a single American being killed.
That's correct. We had two soldiers injured. One of my squad leaders was shot in the hand, and he ended up coming back to us within a couple of weeks. And one of the soldiers from one of the reinforcing platoons received a blast injury, and he was able to come back within a couple of months. No Americans got killed in that battle, but you know, I'd say we were pretty lucky, and I've always said that I'd rather be lucky than good.
So. Right. You're fighting for 6 hours, like I said before, in 120-degree heat, dehydrated, nearly completely exhausted. What's going through your mind during all of this, and what's keeping you going?
Well, I think what kept me going was pretty much the constant threat. I knew that we had to stay active, and we had to stay proactive in order to keep them off of us, since they did have that alleyway that they could get up, and we didn't have a way of effectively controlling that alleyway, you know, being a relatively small element. I mean, the scout platoon, it's 45 men, but that includes your military intelligence folks, your Air Force Joint Tactical Air Controllers, and your mortar platoon. So really, as far as the, you know, infantrymen on the ground, I was only had about 28, and that gets spread thin pretty quickly.
And very few people who will hear this obviously are going to find themselves in a situation like you did. What makes you react like this? Is it training? Is it instinct? What is it that causes you to when you're in this kind of situation, have that reaction?
It's definitely the training. You know, we train for this, especially in the reconnaissance world. We train for being outnumbered because we always are. So that definitely helps. We have drills that are set up for situations like this. And we also train with combat multipliers all the time, you know, things like mortars, artillery, and close air support. So we're very adept at using those things, and that helps us out. We're also typically pretty good shooters because we have snipers that we train with all the time, and a lot of our soldiers are actually formally sniper trained. So that works out for us. But what works to our advantage is that we don't have machine guns integral to our platoon, so that's what hurts us sometimes, particularly with our dismounted movement. And then also just having a great group of guys, you know, that definitely helps all the time.
Well, what were you thinking when you find out down the road that you'll be that you would be receiving the Silver Star?
I didn't expect it. I didn't think that I had done anything that was different from what anybody else would do, and I'd still hold true to that. It's really more of a situation that the enemy puts you in than something that you put, you know, a situation that you put yourself in. So I didn't expect it. As far as I was concerned, I had just done what I was supposed to do. As an infantryman, my job is to close with and destroy the enemy, and that's what we did. So I was pretty surprised when I found out that I'd be getting any Valor Award at all.
And what have you been up to since that deployment, and what are your future plans?
Well, I got back from that deployment, and my platoon sergeant time is pretty much over, so I decided to move up to the U.S. Military Academy up here at West Point, and now I'm a NCO tactical advisor for a cadet company. So I have about 140 cadets that I work with on our daily basis. It's a nice job. It's a gorgeous area. A lot of history, Revolutionary War history and whatnot up here. And I enjoy working with the cadets because they're just like soldiers to me.
Sergeant First Class William Tomlin, thank you for your service.